Like I say, you know, the first month I was there, I've seen rapes and robberies and murders, and I've seen all kinds of things in that prison. And you have to learn quickly how to survive in that type of environment. So I got a job working in the hospital. I was a janitor. And I worked there, and I was what they call a runner. I was a connection man. I was a connection between the hospital and the yard. Anybody wanted anything, I could go in the hospital or come out. I would be a mule. Mm-hmm. I was a connection. Mm-hmm. And I worked on that job there for about 3 months, and they promoted me to a clerk on third shift. I worked in third shift. But during that time, I learned fast in prison how to be a loan shark. I learned how to survive. I learned how to get along with the officers, how to get along with people you deal with, how to keep your mouth shut, and how to make yourself some money and not trust nobody. I learned quickly that you walk lightly among the dead and trust not a living soul. You know, and that's what I learned as an important lesson, and that's what it's taken me. And I stayed in Central Prison for 4 years. And it was a lot of drugs coming in prison during that time. So they called me and asked me what I informed them about where the drugs was coming in. Now, you just don't do that kind of talking. Your life is very important. So I told them I didn't understand what they was talking about. So they gave me a decision. They said, if you cooperate, we'll do something for you. If you don't cooperate with you, we're going to do something for you anyway. So I didn't cooperate, so they sent me to the farm, Odom Farm.
Tillery.
At Tillery, North Carolina, Northampton County. 10,000 acres. Catonia and Odom sits on this area. They raise corn, potatoes, cotton, everything else in the world. And this is where inmates work in the fields and other jobs as well. So they put me out in the fields picking squash and tomatoes and stuff. And I worked out there for a period of time, and I became the water boy, and I worked there, and I stayed out there for a while. Then eventually I worked in the kitchen. And I raised from the fields to the kitchen. And I was blessed to go in the kitchen and work, and I was taught how to bake by name Billy Rose. He's a fine man.
Was he an inmate or a...
No, he was a steward. So he was a steward. He was a farmer. But he worked for the state. Mm-hmm. Kitchen steward. He taught me how to bake. And from then on, I was blessed with a gift of baking.
So you discovered that you had that gift of...
Yes. I was discovered. Never thought I had it before.
It was revealed.
And it was revealed. Yes, it was. And from then on, my baking skills... matter of fact, there was a lady by the name of Miss Parks that was a correction officer in Odom. She told me one day, she said, Otis, she said, you are going to be a great baker one day. And she said, you will be a great baker for the governor. And I saw this lady here about 3 weeks ago. She transferred up here where I'm at now. And she said, you remember what I told you? You know, so she prophesied that, she predicted that. So she's on the camp now. So they sent me in March of 83, they sent me to Odom Farm. So when I got to Odom Farm and I worked, as I said, in the fields and back and forth, went to the kitchen. And I worked there and I stayed there from 83 to 1992. And during that time, I saw men get stabbed, I saw men get raped. The farms was worse.
Worse than Central Prison?
Worse than Central Prison. It was worse because you had outright homosexuals. You had men sleeping with men in the same bed. You had men marrying men. You had men writing home to their wives and telling them, "I don't love you no more. I don't want you no more." And one thing led to another. So in 1983, I had an opportunity to leave... Odom Farm. This was publicized in the paper, so it's not really nothing too drastic is that the assistant superintendent, he had spoke to me the day before he left. Mm-hmm. And he had he went home that evening and he committed suicide. And I shipped right after that. They moved me to Johnson County. I think I was about to land. I talked to him before he left. So they moved me to Johnson County. And I stayed in Johnson County, worked there about 30 days and left Johnson County and went to Ashburn. And that time, everywhere I go, I bake. I worked in Ashburn in the kitchen and well, it was the canteen. And I got in some difficulties at the Ashburn. I came up in the canteen, short of money. And they moved me from Ashburn. I went to Caswell. Caswell wanted me to come up and bake because I had met the assistant superintendent at Caswell that he would come to Ashburn once a week. Mm-hmm. And he got familiar with me.
By this point, you were getting a reputation as a baker.
Yes, sir. Everybody around the state knew me, and every camp really wanted me. Mm-hmm. Because I could do anything. I could bake, regardless of what it was, I could bake.
Now, in a prison, what do you get to do? What kind of things do you bake in a prison?
Well, in a prison, the daily routine would be rolls, biscuits every day. Biscuits or rolls every day. As well as some type of cake. They have a menu that comes out of Raleigh. Uh-huh. But usually, it's very simple things like cake, apple pie, blueberry pie, or something like that. Mm-hmm. Nothing extraordinary. Nothing gourmet,
right.
Basically. We serve a lot of pudding and a lot of fruits. But everywhere I would go, we wouldn't serve that. You know, I would always make something. Mm-hmm. Because one can of fruit will probably cost you $30, and I can make 10 cakes for that, you know, basically, you know. So I always enjoy baking. That's what I would do. Mm-hmm. But where most of your great baking will come in at is when we have those meetings, those state meetings. Mm-hmm. You have a lot of state officials comes out of Raleigh and different places. Mm-hmm. And they have these little meetings on the camp, and they would always ask me, say, well, we got a meeting coming up. We want you to mm-hmm. take care of some of the food and this and that, this and that. And I would be blessed to be able to do that. I have a famous thing called apple turnovers and apple jacks, the old-timers. Ooh. And I would make all that stuff, make the rolls and make all that and set it out. And they all would say, well, who is the, let me see this guy, you know. And my reputation began to move around a little bit. Uh-huh. But at the same time, I thought that was the greatest thing that I could receive was a reputation. But later on, I found out it was character. You know, that's what I really wanted. Mm-hmm. So, got to Caswell. I worked there for a while, and I was baking. And by the way, too, is everywhere I done went, my name is still in the camp. Camps would always want me to come back. Every camp that I have been on, I've left a good reputation. I've always worked hard. I always did a great job. I've never received any gain time. Many people receive gain time for what they do. That's why they work. All the years I've been in prison, I've never received any gain time.
Gain time, that's...
Gain time is that you work and you get some time off your sentence.
Right.
Everybody in prison does that.
Uh-huh.
You work, you get time off.
Right.
But I've never had any time off my sentence. Because under the way my sentence was constructed, uh-huh. This new law doesn't require you to get anything either. But I didn't get anything, but I worked every day anyway. And so I worked over there, and I left there and went to Reesville, North Carolina. Uh-huh. And I got to Reesville, and before I unpacked my bags, I walked in the kitchen and told the man, and I was assigned to go to Reesville to work in the kitchen. But when I got there, the man told me, says, there's no way possible you're going to work in my kitchen. He said, because I've heard about you, and he said, you'll take my kitchen. But, you know, when I went into
it. Right.
Yeah, well, I absolutely was right. You know, when I work in a kitchen, you know, during that time, what I would do, I would set up a little organization. Uh-huh. I would set up an organization where I would take hamburgers and chickens and everything. That was a famous thing that only in the institution. In the institution, hamburgers, fried chicken, and peanut butter is the three commodities that you got.
Uh-huh.
If you got hamburgers, fried chicken, and peanut butter, you got a winner.
You're gonna be all right.
You can make money.
Right. Uh-huh. Right.
They don't want anything else. That's famous. peanut butter is used to be top of the list.
Uh-huh.
They would kill over peanut butter
because
you don't get that much.
Uh-huh.
So I would set me a little organization where I would get men lined up. I'd get four or five men lined up there. I would take burgers, cook the burgers, have one man to wrap the burgers up,
uh-huh.
and I would have another man to carry the burgers and get rid of them. So we had a little organization. And we would set everything up, and that's why we would roll.
Uh-huh.
That's everywhere we went. And, but they was on to me at Caswell.
Uh-huh.
And they was going to move me. So I figured, I might as well move
uh-huh.
before they move.
Yeah.
So I asked them what they sent me. So they sent me up to Reedsville, a little place up in Reedsville. Now, a small camp. He had about 65, 66 people on this camp. And I stayed there. And the man told me up there in the kitchen, he says, I'm not going to let you work. You know, he said, you'll take my kitchen, so. And he was right. And so they had put me on the list to transfer because I had too much time to stay on the camp. I couldn't work outside the fence. Uh-huh. So in the meantime, I'm still working on the camp. And I still set up shop. I started long sharking and started card games and started this, started that. And I met an officer named Ernest Jones. He was a preacher of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And he would tell me about Jesus every day. And the way he would do, if you got a write-up, and the way you could get off money to this write-up, you had to sit down and let him counsel you. And he would counsel you about Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. And that was appropriate if you got one, which I never got one. But
right.
I would have took that avenue. You know? And But I became very fond of this man. I wasn't in favor of his type of lifestyle, what he said, but
uh-huh.
I liked him. It was just something about the man, you know, he was a kind man. And even a dog recognized kindness. So me and him would talk every day. We would debate. I would tell him about the Quran and
uh-huh.
and tell him about the white man and tell him about this and that, the contradictions I seen in the Bible.
Uh-huh.
And he would explain to me and this and that, this and that. And because I was natural-minded, I couldn't understand what he was saying. But eventually, things happened, though. He took off from work a couple of weeks on vacation, and I kind of missed this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And when he came back, he asked me, would I go to church? And I said, yes. With the ideal, I said, well, if I do him a favor, he'll do me a favor.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I could get something from him. So that's what happened. So I went. That was April the 8th, 1994.
This was a service at the camp.
On the camp.
Yeah.
That's right. And the most radical thing was a service that was held by a white church out of Greensboro.
Uh-huh.
And I wasn't too much into white people, you know.
Yeah.
You know, because here I am going to a white service. But I went.
And you're a black Muslim.
And I'm, yes, sir. So I went. And when I got in there, I didn't understand what was going on. It didn't faze me, you know. But I was more interested in what I saw. You know, a natural-minded man, he can identify to something he can see.
Mm-hmm.
But all this hokey-pokey, what this man talking about Jesus Christ, I'm not interested in that. Mm-hmm. That don't mean nothing to me. So eventually, things happened. I seen the little kids over in the corner. I was attracted to that. And he finished his sermon, and he made his invitation to come to Christ. Now, that is what did something to me. Just a simple word. I really believe that God was already dealing with me. And when he done that, I stood up. And as I stood up, I looked around. There was one more other man, a guy named Roger Blackstar. And he was standing up at the same time. And a voice said in my head, it was so very clear to me, the voice said, what are you doing? And it said it again two times, what are you doing? And by that time, I was finna sit down, and two old white men come over to me and hugged me and started crying.
Now, were they inmates or they were from the church?
It's from the church.
Uh-huh.
And they started crying to me, and they was telling me about how Jesus loved me and all that. There. And I was just messed up. Ain't nobody never grabbed me and hugged me and cried and stuff like that, you know.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I was just really out of it, man. And I kneeled down. I remember that day, man, this knee here I had arthritis. And he tried to pull me down on this knee, but I didn't want to go. I was trying to go on this knee. But anyway, I went down on this knee. But I never had no more problem with this knee. And I accepted Christ that day. I prayed that prayer with him. And I still didn't understand what was going on. But when I walked out that church, man, I knew there was something different about me. I suppose that an experience like that is not going to happen to everybody. We all got different experiences, you know. I didn't see no great lights, and I didn't see no big shadow coming through the window. It wasn't nothing like that. I just felt.
You felt different.
You know, it's like a pair of pants that you got. You may have many different pair of pants, but there's always one pair.
Yeah.
It's always one pair.
Yeah.
You don't have to, nobody don't have to tell you, say, hey, those pants look good. It feels good on you. You already know it. So when that happened to me, the feeling, mm-hmm. I knew it. It was something about the feeling mm-hmm. that really just captivated me. Mm-hmm. And I walked outside and I told the Muslim brothers, I said, brother, I've accepted Christ as my Savior. They told me I was crazy. And they didn't speak to me. They stayed away from me. The Christian brothers on the camp stayed away from me. They didn't associate with me either because they thought that I was running some kind of scam. They had passed the word that he's going to take over here and he's going to do this and he's going to do this, you know. But I wasn't interested in that. I just wanted the fellowship. I wanted to learn. So I spent all my time during the day and all that reading and studying. Some of the brothers put me out of the church, the Christian brothers, because they thought that they seen me talking to some Muslims one day. So they thought that I was scheming a plan, whatever. But God bless me, you know, to be able to weather that storm, because what I had, I really believe that God did, that man didn't give it to me. Mm-hmm. I believe I got it from God.
And what year was that?
That was 1995.
In Reedsville?
Yes, sir. It was 94. Well, see, 94, what it was, I accepted. Well, 94, that was, well, 95, well, that was like after the Christmas time, you know. Mm-hmm. And I left Reedsville in 95. And, so what happened was during that time, though, before I left, they got a little perplexed on me. They called in a psychiatrist, Dan Crandall. They wanted to find out what was wrong with me, you know, and man wrote a report and said he was fine. He just got saved. The chaplain on the camp named Kenny Dishman. I found this out later that they had called him and find out what was going on with me. And he told me the guy just got saved. Somebody reported to them that I was planning on escaping. So they sent me from Reedsville back to Caswell with the $1 million fence. Mm. You know, they had $1 million fence, so you can't get away from there. But that's where God wanted me at, in Reedsville, and me in Caswell. So I stayed there for a period of time, and we was blessed, had about 6 people in service. And we prayed, and we were just blessed to have 40, 50, 60, 70 people, and we just had, just he just added on to the church. And we prayed for 100 people. The most I ever seen in the church was 99. And that's when, October 17th, they called me and told me that 8 o'clock in the morning. Now, I don't qualify for anything. My date for prison is 2028. At that time, I've already served somewhere in the area of 17 years.
Now, 2028, that's when you'd first be eligible for parole?
That's when I had to leave prison.
Okay.
That's when I leave prison, okay. 2028. I already had served like 17 years already, and I still had a few years to go.
Yeah.
So, and that's when they called me. And then, so they called and told me that October 17th, 1995, they called and told me that they had received a fax paper in from Raleigh. Now, I had never heard of fax. Hmm. I mean, I've been locked up in prison. I've never heard of caller ID. You know, I mean, I don't know anything about that. But it told me something about fax. You know, they just sent it in to me that I had made honor grade and they were supposed to put me in right away. This is October 17th. And I explained to them, I said, well, how are you going to put me in honor grade because I haven't had a psychiatric evaluation? So they showed me a report that the psychiatrist had wrote about me. That's what really...
That was the Caldwell?
That was at Caswell.
Caswell.
Yeah.
The psychiatrist's name.
The psychiatrist was Dan Crandall.
Crandall, that's right.
Yeah, he wrote this little report on me that I was such a outstanding inmate in the community, you know, that sort of thing. So that was the greatest asset, you know, for me to make what I made. That was a piece of it. That's being set up. I didn't notice. So anyway, October 17th, 95. October 18th, they called me to the clothes house and told me I was shipping. October 19th, I was at Tillery. The stipulation was I had to stay at Tillery 5 years. And after 5 years, I have to go to another level one camp. I could never make level two until about 15 years because of my time, whatever I had. So anyway, I said, well, all right. So I was at Tillery. I started working in the kitchen. I started as a baker. And from there, after 6 months, they called me to meet the board. And when I met the board, they told me that I had too much time to ship. I had too many problems, too many difficulties. So they said, well, all right. And 2 weeks later, I got a notice that I was going to be shipping the next morning. But the superintendent stopped that order because he wanted me to stay on that camp. I had too much time. Mm-hmm. I became very frustrated, so I decided to just quit my job. You know, because I was disappointed.
You are free to do. I mean, this like when you have a job in a prison like this, you have the freedom to quit?
No, sir, you don't. No, sir, you don't.
Called a hole.
That's right. Now, if you do quit, you got to pay the consequences.
The hole, that's solitary.
Like going to solitary.
Right.
That's right.
So if you quit, that's what you're supposed to do.
That's right. But mainly, they wasn't interested in me going to the hole. They wanted to play me all the way out to the end. Because, see, I was an asset to them.
As a baker.
And they had a lot of guests coming in from Raleigh, and they wanted to impress. So they gave me a little leeway, which I didn't even think about the consequences of being locked up anyway. The only thing I thought about was the fact that here is almost 17 years I've never been close to home. And I wanted to be close to home. McLeansville would have put me somewhere like 2 miles or 3 miles away from my house. And I wanted the opportunity to do that. So after the superintendent took my name off, I went to the steward in the kitchen and told him, I said, I'm giving you 2 weeks. And I went to the program and told him, I'm giving you 2 weeks. That's it. I thought about it for a couple of days and I went back to him. I was kind of convicted. I told him, I said, listen, I said, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to work. And I couldn't find the programmer. He wasn't available. So about 4 or 5 days later, I seen him sitting in his office. I was going to church. And I stopped in to tell him that I wanted to reconsider by quitting and so forth. So when I walked in, he said, come on in. He says, I was going to call you. He says, the paperwork is already taken care of. So I said, I just come in here to tell this guy that I was going to, you know, I was going to quit. But he didn't already put the paperwork in, so I didn't say anything. He said, that means that you're leaving tomorrow. I said, tomorrow? I said, where I'm going? I'm thinking, well, I said, just because I'm going to quit, they're going to ship me away, you know. He said, we got a call and a letter from the governor's mansion that they want you to come up to the governor's mansion and bake for the governor. So I said, that was an honor. That knocked me off my feet. I never applied for nothing like that. I really didn't know nothing about it that much. I've heard people talk about working up there. But most of the inmates that do work there, they're yard men. And they do house duties too, but most of them yard guys. And I was excited. So I told him, I said, well, I said, the superintendent's not going to let me go. I said, because he's already done canceled one appointment. So he told me, he said, no, he said, he can't stop this. So I was on the way again, you know. So I went to a place, they were sending me a place called Umstead. Now, Umstead is a place where every inmate in the state is trying to get to because there's no fence. It's got a pond where you go fishing. It's got all that. You know, they give you a fishing rod. I mean, you know, it's got rabbits walking around. It's got live ducks sitting around and play with the squirrels. I mean, it's an unbelievable place. So the only thing I thought about, I said, well, there's no way possible that he can receive me there because I got too much time. Nobody with a life sentence go to Umstead.
Right.
Nobody with my time. Nobody's been in prison. Guys go to Umstead that's been down for 3 months, 6 months, got a little time to go. But nobody's like me. So all the way over there thinking, I said, well, when I get up there, what they gonna do? They gonna just send me back anyway. So we got to Guest Road in Durham, and the officer told everybody to get off the bus. And when he said get off the bus, I knew right then that it was true, that they didn't want me, that they had tricked me. So I told the officer, I said, sir, I thought I was supposed to go to Armstead. He said, everybody has to get off the bus here to wait for the next bus. I was relieved. So anyway, I went on to Armstead. It was raining that day, and they had the superintendent out there waiting for me.
And Armstead was nice.
Unbelievable. It was paradise. I mean, it was like paradise, man. I mean, it's like you're not even in prison no more. You're in college, man. You know, the place is real nice, you know. I mean,
how much rent you have to pay a month to live in there? Me and David might like to go ourselves.
Well, I think those facilities is not adequate for you. You know, I mean, but that's paradise for me.
It's a comparative thing, yeah.
Because I've been living in such a place all my life.
So the superintendent's waiting for you.
So he's waiting for me. And he tells me, he said, you owe this officer. And the officer called my name, owe this officer. He said, yes, you owe this officer. He said, listen. He said, we got an order for you to process you right away. He says, you don't have to unpack nothing. Just go on in. Usually when you first get there, they put you in an open bay area. But they put me in a room with two men with a bathtub and a shower. And I ain't been in a bathtub in 17 years, you know. I don't know anything about that. Mm-hmm. You know, I never touched one.
Right.
So I don't know about it. So he says, he said, we're going to process you right away. We're going to get you up to Raleigh. That's all right. So the next day, the programmer called me. And he told me, he said, listen, he said, we've been waiting on you. He said, they should have been had you up here. And he says, just a minute. He get on the phone, he called Raleigh. He talked to somebody in Raleigh. The man said, yes, I got him here. And he hung the phone up. And this was the time, man, it was a lot of snow and ice on the ground, too, man. And he got off the phone. He said, they'll be here tomorrow. I mean, snow and ice, man. These people came down there. They came down there to see me. I mean, they treated me like I was some type of dignitary, man. I mean, I was in prison, man, you know. So they talked real nice to me. And it was a couple of the officials from the governor's office. They talked real nice to me. And they told me that they was going to give me a evaluation test and check me out, this and that, ask me a few questions. And obviously I satisfied them. But they had heard about me. They didn't talk about it. And so...
What do you mean that they had heard about you?
Well, they had heard about me and so forth, me baking.
Right.
The skill that I had, you know. Mm-hmm. So I finished the process in 2 weeks. Well, 2.5 weeks. Usually take 3 months, 2 months, 3 months. But I finished the whole process in 2.5 weeks. And in 2.5 weeks, I was sent to Raleigh, July 1st. 1996, July 1st. Now, that was the memorious time I ever spent in my life.
What'd you think the first time you saw the governor's mansion?
Well, the greatest thing was when I got in the car to ride up there, I rode in the front seat. I hadn't rode in a car in 15 years, you know. I mean, you know, in the front seat of a car with no shackles. I went out the gate with no shackles. For all these years, that's all I've been doing is walking around in shackles.
Every time you go between prisons?
Every time I go out that gate. Before I go out that gate, I'm handcuffed, I'm shackled. If I go to the dentist, I'm shackled. Wherever I go, I'm shackled. I'm shackled and shackled. And with a man with a gun and stuff like that, I walked out that gate. And 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, and I saw stars, man, in the air, you know, in the sky, with no shackles on. That was the most greatest time in my life, man. That was the greatest thing ever happened to me. I mean, that was a blessing to me. And to walk in, and the man says, I tell you what, he says, the car parked over there. You know, the car parked over there. I'm waiting. I got to stay close to him. He said, go on, get in the car. First time ever happened to me. I'm, you know. So I went on, walked over there and got in the car and sit in the front seat. And I was afraid all the way to Raleigh because that was the first time I had rode in the front seat. And I kept, you know, I'm thinking the brakes are going to give out or something, or guy going to run into the back of a car or something. So I went up there for my interview, you know, and I passed my interview. And I started working 4 or 5 days later.
And what did you think when you first get there? I mean, was it intimidating?
Well, yes, it was. That was the first time I crossed the street, too. I was afraid to cross the street. And like, 16 years, you know, uh-huh. I was afraid to cross the street. It's almost 17 years. And then when I walked up to the gate with the officer and the gate open, and I walked inside the government mail, that was the most beautiful place I've ever seen. And there's guys working on the yard. They all knew me. Uh-huh. They knew I was coming. Uh-huh. But word had got around. Uh-huh. And that was a very rewarding and a momentous experience in my life. I'll never forget that. That was July 1st.
And then you walk into the kitchen.
And I didn't go in the kitchen.
That was just the interview.
As far as I got was the basement. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's the first I got was the basement. I never seen the kitchen until I really started working there. So I worked I came there a few days later. Uh-huh. And I went in the kitchen. And the best opportunity of my life. Best experience. It's an honor for me. And it's a privilege to work at the governor's mansion, to work